yesterday just talking about black holes and thinking a little bit about the causal structure of black holes. So I described to you how you construct a Penrose diagram and what a Penrose diagram is. And we met the Kerr black holes. So that was a sort of relatively hands-on lecture. So I'm going to kind of just use a couple of observations about black holes at the start of this lecture to kind of set us off on a new little detour where we're going to cover a couple of things that are actually pretty useful in terms of thinking about gravity in more of a similar way to the way that we think about field theory. So today we're going to derive an action, a sort of Lagrangian principle for Einstein gravity. And tomorrow we'll have to sort of do a little bit more of a geometric digression to kind of round that description off and to sort of understand how it really works. So to start off, I just want to make a couple of relatively straightforward, but maybe a little bit bizarre observations about the Schwarzschild solution. So the first thing I want to do is to take the Schwarzschild solution and to rotate to Euclidean time. This is something that we often do in field theory. And if I do that, I get a metric that has a consistent signature. So we take our Schwarzschild metric, and we simply put everything plus. So we say this is a Euclidean metric because it's plus, 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 plus. So that would be our Euclidean Schwarzschild metric. And now we sort of have to think about what that means. So that's it's now a sort of proper Riemannian manifold, but it's not flat. And it also, you know, it has this issue at r equals 2gm. So we cannot now take r less than 2gm and still maintain the signature of our metric. So this is only valid for r greater than or equal to 2gm. With the Lorentzian metric, we had a coordinate singularity at 2gm, but we could go beyond it. Here we're kind of, that's a sort of hard limit, r equals 2gm. So let's look at what happens as r goes to 2gm. So we know that in the Lorentzian metric, our sort of classic black hole, this is not a physical singularity, it's just a coordinate singularity. So if we look near 2gm, then this is what the sort of, if we think just about what's happening in the RT plane, our tau plane, this is what we get. Now, although we've got metric coefficients going to zero or blowing up, if we look at this, this is not, it's not a bad singularity because this just looks like d of the square root of r minus 2gm. So it suggests that we take a new radial coordinate, which is the square root of r minus 2gm. So let's sort of look or try something proportional to square root of r minus 2gm. So we're going to try a new radial coordinate. such that rho squared is lambda times r minus 2 gm. So if I then look, take d rho, I find that rho d rho goes like lambda dr. So I can I square it to look at, you know, sort of move towards what I've got in the metric, I see that now I've achieved my purpose, which is to get something that looks like dr squared over r minus 2 gm. But I've got, you can see now why I've put this lambda in, because ideally what I would like to do is to turn this term here into d rho squared, and I'm just going to fix lambda to make that the case. So if I choose lambda equals 8 gm, then I've just got a d rho squared in the metric. And so this is what I get. If I just sort of, just so that it's kind of clear, if I now set a new time coordinate chi as tau over 4 gm, I get something that's very familiar. The sort of tr part of my metric is d rho squared plus rho squared d chi squared. So this is just the metric near the origin in polar coordinates. With one caveat, of course, and that is provided that the periodicity of this angular variable is 2 pi, which would give you that the periodicity of tau, which we label beta, is 8 pi gm. So by rotating to Euclidean time, in our Schwarzschild solution, we have an interpretation of a curved geometry where we've got our two spheres, so we've got our r squared, d omega squared, but in the tau r plane, we've got something that is smooth, can be smoothly closed off at 2 gm, provided we make Euclidean time periodic. So why is that important? Well, if you get a periodic Euclidean time, this is indicative of a field theory at a finite temperature. So it's how you do field theory at finite temperature. which is sort of inversely proportional to the periodicity of Euclidean time. So this rather, I'm going to check my notes for all the factors of H bar and what have you when you reinstate them. So this rather simple argument is saying that if we try to start thinking about our space-times in perhaps with a bit more of a field theory perspective, our black hole turns out to have some feature at least of a finite temperature. Now, of course, we know that we know the full story. We know that black holes do indeed radiate. They have a Hawking temperature, and this is the Hawking temperature. Now, that was not the way it was first calculated, but later on in the 1970s, when Stephen Hawking and Gary Gibbons were thinking more about sort of black holes and gravity, they did actually use this Euclidean prescription. And nowadays, if you want to calculate the temperature of a black hole or a black brain, this is the method you use. You go to Euclidean time and look for the periodicity. So that's sort of one little observation. And before sort of getting on to thinking about actions, I just want to make another apparently trivial observation. So just notice that for the Schwarzschild solution, our mass is related to the event horizon radius via this sort of very simple rewriting of R plus is 2gm. So if I thought of a process, a dynamical process, in which the mass of the black hole changed, the only thing that can change in that equation on the right-hand side is R plus, and then I can say, well, okay, that's delta of R plus squared divided by 4g R plus, and then I can carry on my rewriting and say that that is now delta 1 over 8 pi gm delta of the area of the event horizon over 4g. So that first term here, the 1 over 8 pi gm, is a t. This is like, potentially at least, it's a shift in energy. Well, I'm going to argue later in the course it's not quite energy. And so this here looks like a delta S. So this is looking like thermodynamics. Now, I'm kind of doing this all backwards because, of course, originally it was noticed that the black hole satisfied a sort of area theorem. If you have positive energy, then the area of a black hole can only ever increase. So this is this idea, nothing can escape. The black hole is only an absorber. So therefore, everything, it must always get bigger. It never gets smaller, at least classically. And so this idea that the area always increased, plus the fact of thinking about having your, you know, the universe as a thermodynamical system, and if you think of a thermodynamical process, if you just had a load of junk and decided to sort of tip it down the black hole, if the black hole had no entropy, you would be violating the second law of thermodynamics. So that was what led Bekenstein to sort of conjecture that the area had something to do with the entropy of a black hole. But then, of course, if you start assigning a black hole thermodynamic quantities, then a black body does tend to have a black body temperature, and therefore black holes should radiate. So that was the sort of that, in a sense, the story of black hole thermodynamics started here and kind of works back. Nonetheless, this is really just a few sort of observations to kind of motivate a rather long discussion of starting to think about black holes and how we might sort of talk about gravity and field theory. So if we wanted to do sort of think about the thermodynamics of a black hole, what we might want to do is to sort of construct a partition function for the black hole. Now, that's sort of fraught with all sort of, sometimes I sort of say when you're doing this partition function for gravity, it's all a little bit creaky because it's not truly a well-defined process. We don't have a theory of quantum gravity, but this Euclidean approach where you find classical Euclidean solutions and you kind of tiptoe through this notion of Euclidean quantum gravity, it works, and it works much better than it has any right to. So what we're going to do first is to think about what is a gravitational action, and then we can think about trying to derive some of this thermodynamics from a sort of partition function approach. So it's going to take us a couple of lectures though. So, our partition function would be something like finite temperature, would be something like a trace over states of the beta, this 1 over T, times the Hamiltonian or some sort of energy. And of course, this actually translates into a kind of Euclidean action. So that's really what's motivating, in part, our way of finding a way of getting an action for gravity. So if we're going to find a gravitational action, our first step is to think, well, how are we going to do integration? And in a sense, if we want to talk about actions in general and think about finding an action for a field, just a normal field theory on curved space, we also need to be able to integrate on a curved manifold. So typically, when we first discussed manifolds last week, we talked about how we transported concepts from the underlying charts, the R to the N, the flat, the flat space-time, and how we imported notions from that onto our curved manifold. So here, if we want to integrate on our curved manifold, we have to sort of think, well, how do we know how to integrate on R to the N, so how do we lift that concept into the manifold? So D4X, for example, if we think about our coordinate box, this is not a legitimate measure. So what we need is a measure to integrate on our manifold. So under a coordinate transformation, D4X goes like one of those densities. we get the Jacobian factor. D4x gets a factor of dx prime by dx. But if we multiply by the square root of the determinant of the metric, then we do get a covariant expression. So what this is it's saying that our coordinates have no intrinsic meaning. Coordinates are just that. They're just a choice of labels on our curved manifold. What is a physical volume element? What is our physical measure? Well, it's this volume of the coordinate box done by little dt, dx, dy, dz. And so what this root g, d4x is it's actually the volume, the physical volume . So we have this notion of a coordinate cube, and when we multiply by root g, we get the physical volume inside that little cube. So that's our appropriate measure to do the integration on our manifold. So we pick a chart and we multiply by root g. So then let's just see, what do we do? So our physical field in gravity is the metric. And so now you can see that even with just looking at our volume form, this now has some dependence on our physical field in gravity. So if we're varying an action with respect to the metric, we need to know how to vary that root g. And so we use an identity that the determinant of a matrix is the exponential of the trace of the log of a matrix. So that means that if we take delta of det m, it allows us It's not what it says on the tin. It's supposed to be the front and the middle here. Ha. Hopefully that's readable. So we simply use that identity to find the variation of our root g.
Question.
Yep.
Right. What do you mean up there by physical volume?
So the dx, dt, or so it's easier to just think of it in three dimensions. So dx times dy times dz is not the physical volume of that little cube. It's just the volume of the little cube in our cubed, you know, our underlying flat. You know, we have our curve manifold, and then we have our underlying flat Cartesian space-time, and our chart is just a map the coordinates from the curved manifold into our underlying flat, R cubed in that case. So D3x, although it's a perfectly fine measure in flat R cubed, it's just the volume of the coordinate box, not the volume in the curved manifold. To get the volume in the curved manifold, we need to know things. It's really the physical distance in dx and the physical distance in dy and the physical distance in dz. And so that's where the root g comes in. So our coordinates have no absolute meaning. They're just labels. But what we want is we want to have a physical integral. We want to have some invariant meaning. And so we have to find the physical volume of that box.
Does that mean if I took a physical ruler and measured it, it would give me that one instead of the D4, instead of the coordinate volume?
If you sat there and measured it yourself, yeah, that's, yes. Okay. Because if you sat and measured it with a physical ruler, what you're doing is you're using GAB to measure that distance.
Okay.
So in essence, the reason you're getting this square root of g is because when you take volumes, what you're really doing is you're taking dx wedge dy wedge dz. That's, you know, so if you want to, you know, you can think of this actually as it's, you know, on the plane, the area is sort of the spanned by a box is actually the vector product of two vectors. So if you're, you know, so it's coming, the root g is coming from actually trying to physically construct this little box in your space-time. Yeah. So if you sat and you measured the volume of that box with a ruler, then that is what you'd get, that root g, you'd get the actual volume, yeah. So it's, I mean, not only is it sort of covariant if you look at it from the perspective of the transformation, the coordinate transformation, because d4x is a density, probably get my signs, a density of weight minus one, and root g is a density of weight one, or the other way around. So you see that is covariant from the perspective of a coordinate transformation. But also, if you step back and just think, well, what is the volume anyway of a box? You would get that root g factor in. So, okay, so applying that identity, if I take delta of det g, or delta of root g, I get root g again, times g inverse delta g, traced. So that's what that identity is telling me. In practice, and it'll sort of become obvious in very quickly, what we do is we vary with respect to the inverse metric. Now, since we're assuming that our manifolds are smooth, our metric has an inverse, it should be equivalent. And it just turns out to be a more efficient way of doing things. So let's see it as an example. So we're just going to look, rather than thinking about gravity yet, let's just make sure this makes sense by looking at something familiar, a massless scalar field. So we know what the Lagrangian for a massless scalar is. We normally write it as a half grad phi squared. It just has a kinetic term. And we know how to make that curved space. We just take, we know that in curved space, the covariant derivative of a scalar is the partial derivative, and we're just taking the magnitude of that. So we have one power of inverse g. So our action for the scalar should just be the integral of that Lagrangian over our proper volume. So our variational instructions tell us we take our action and we allow all the physical fields in it to vary. So that's what we'll do. We've only got two physical fields there, one of which is the one we're used to varying, which is the scalar field phi, but now we've got the metric sitting in there, and so we're going to imagine that we can vary the metric. So I go through, I vary my phi, so I get two terms, both of which are the same because G is symmetric. And so that gives me the first term here, grad phi, grad delta phi. Then I vary the inverse metric in the d phi squared. Then I vary root G. So I integrate by parts. This is the sort of classic, I should put here inverted commas. I've integrated by parts and I've assumed that delta phi equals zero on the boundary, whatever the boundary is. So this, we know, should be equal to the functional derivative of S with respect to phi times delta phi and the derivative of S with respect to G mean U times delta G mean U. So that is the definition of our functional derivatives, and our equations of motion are that the functional derivatives of the action with respect to our physical variables vanish. So here we see that delta S by delta phi equals zero implies the wave equation for phi, which is of course our massless scalar wave equation, with the only little proviso, you've seen it so far just in flat space-time, and all this is saying, well, you just do the same thing, but you take the covariant wave operator. So the curvature of space just changes a little bit what you mean by the D'Alembertian. But then we also have this second piece here. This is twice delta S by delta G. And this is actually equal to the energy momentum tensor for your scalar field. So what we see here is that if we take our obvious scalar Lagrangian, we get the scalar wave equation, the equation of motion for our scalar field by varying the action with respect to phi. But if we vary the scalar action with respect to the metric, we get the energy momentum tensor. And so that's good news, because if we wanted to have an action principle for gravity, if we want to couple gravity to matter, we expect to get an energy momentum tensor. We expect, you know, one side of our Einstein equations is 8 pi g t mu nu. So now, having convinced ourselves that by looking at a matter action, we get the matter side of the Einstein equations, we now need to figure out how to get the geometry side. So now we want to get our geometric action. And here we're in a little bit, you know, we sort of, if we think about what could it be? From the field theory intuition, we have our physical fields. So we have phi or a gauge field or whatever. We usually have interaction potentials. And then we have our kinetic terms. And the kinetic terms tend to be this canonical term. It's just the gradient energy in the scalar field, d phi squared. The problem with the metric is we can't do that because there's no geometrically invariant expression involving just the first derivative of g. dg, if you like, the gradients of g give us the connection, and the connection is not a gauge invariant object. To get the gauge invariant objects, we have to go to curvature, and the curvature is the second derivative of our metric. So we're now not in a sort of canonical field theory setup. This is not our usual method. So this is not the exterior derivative. I'm just being schematic there. Some derivative of g squared. So we don't have a sort of canonical kinetic term for the metric. So we have to kind of step back and think, well, what do we have? We've got a very good candidate for a scalar in the Ricci scalar. That is dependent on the metric, but it is, of course, second derivatives of the metric. So let's just see what happens if we work with the Ricci scalar. Okay, so if I look at delta r, then I get two terms. I've got something that's the variation of the Ricci tensor and something that gives me the Ricci tensor. Now, when I vary the root g in my action, I would get a minus a half r g mu nu. So this term plus the variation of root g is actually going to give me my Einstein tensor. So this is looking really great, except we have this variation of Ricci. So, you know, is that a problem? So we need to find what that is. So there's a technique that's quite useful for finding the variation of this Ricci tensor, which is called normal coordinates. So normal coordinates are essentially a local inertial frame. So when we think about what do our coordinate charts mean, we just, when we first wrote them down, it was rather mathematical and a bit abstract. It was a map from the manifold into the underlying R to the N. In reality, what they are is they're choosing a frame. When you choose your X, Y, and Z, you're saying, well, this is, you know, I have a time with respect to some observer, and this is my, you know, choice of X, Y, and Z by that observer. So what it means is that you're taking a frame in which the first derivatives of G are zero at a point, but second derivatives of G are not zero. In other words, what we're doing is we're doing a coordinate transformation to make the connection component zero at a particular point, but because they're not zero in the neighborhood of the point, the derivative of the connection is not zero. So what that means is, in normal coordinates, our Riemann tensor is just given by the derivative of the connection. So in normal coordinates, grad is equal to the partial derivative. So if I vary my Riemann, it's just varying my connection in here. But in normal coordinates, this is equal to the covariant derivative of delta gamma. But delta gamma is a tensor. This is a covariant derivative, so this is now a coordinate independent statement. I've managed to write the same thing down, haven't I? That's really rubbish. What have I done? Mu nu comma lambda, and then it should be mu lambda comma nu. So this actually has a name. It's called the Palatini lemma. That gives you the variation of the Ricci. So normal coordinates are kind of quite a useful little tool. The only things to sort of be careful of are, remember that although you can set the connection to zero at a point, you can't set its derivative. And also to just be aware of ordering of derivatives, because we know that commuting derivatives, it gives you curvature. So even though partial derivatives commute, as an absolute statement, covariant derivatives don't commute. Therefore, in normal coordinates, you shouldn't commute partial derivatives because the partial derivatives are actually not partial. Or So now for delta gamma, so to take the variation of the connection, let's think again what we mean by the normal coordinates. So if we wanted to vary delta gamma, if we just thought without thinking what the normal coordinates mean, delta gamma, you'd think, well, hang on, there's a delta G here times this plus this G inverse times the variation of what's inside the brackets. However, when you take this delta of G inverse, what that is going to leave you with is just first derivatives of G. So this doesn't contribute in normal coordinates to the expression for delta gamma. So the only thing you need to vary is that. So you get, that's a half G mu sigma grad lambda delta G plus grad nu delta G . So remember, the comma is the same as semicolon in normal coordinates. So when you let in this expression, if you were to consider the variation of this delta, this inverse metric out front, in normal coordinates, the first derivatives of G vanish. So this bracket would just be zero. So that is now, a covariant expression, because although we've got a metric connection so that grad of G is zero, that doesn't mean that grad of variations of G are zero. So now I can put this expression for delta gamma into that Palatini lemma to get an expression for delta R mu nu. And I also notice this is delta G. I want to now turn that into a delta G inverse. So three of these terms come from the first expression there, the covariant derivative of delta gamma, and then the second piece of delta R mu nu is the trace delta gamma lambda mu, which just is the final term. So this is what you get from normal coordinates. So putting together, I get this expression for delta R mu nu, sorry, delta R. So this term here, delta of Ricci, gives me these second derivatives here of delta G. So this is now the variation of the inverse metric, which is what we used when we looked at the variation of the scalar here. So that means that if I guess that my gravitational action is the Ricci scalar, then then I get what I want. I get my Einstein tensor, and I get things that are total derivatives. So this is a total derivative. So from the perspective of looking at the functional derivative, this integration over the bulk of the manifold, I get something that looks like the Einstein tensor. So I've got the integral over my manifold. But then I also pick up this boundary term, and I'm just going to write it down because normally you're used to just ignoring boundary terms in the when you integrate by parts. But if we look at this bit here, this is now not delta G, it's derivatives of delta G. So typically, on that middle board over there, when I integrated by parts, I said we assume delta phi is zero on the boundary. And that's fine. We can take an arbitrary variation. This is what we normally do. We take an arbitrary variation, but we set it to zero on the boundary. So the problem here is setting delta g to zero on the boundary does not guarantee that that boundary term vanishes. Thank you. So from the perspective of getting a dynamical system of equations of motion, this is not necessarily a problem unless you want a dynamical boundary. And so what we do is we set our Einstein-Hilbert action to be precisely this term with a prefactor that gives us the correct equations of motion. So we saw that the variation of our scalar action with respect to the metric gave us a half t mu nu. So we want to get a half of 1 over 8 pi g mu nu when we vary our bulk action here. So we've derived a gravitational action. That means we sort of feel like we know how to get our gravitational equations of motion from a variational principle. But along the way, we've come with this slightly annoying feature that our boundary term, when we integrate by parts, our boundary integral does not vanish necessarily. All we can really do is to set delta g equals zero on the boundary, and that doesn't guarantee that this boundary term vanishes. So that's kind of annoying, but never mind, we can still get our bulk equations of motion. So from the perspective of solutions to Einstein's equations, it's not an issue. However, I started this whole narrative by talking about the Schwarzschild solution and talking about thermodynamics, and saying, wouldn't it be great if we had an action principle so we could do some sort of partition function in a sort of rather cautious version of Euclidean quantum gravity? And the problem is, if you look at this Einstein action, if we Euclideanize it, it's still going to be an integral of R. And of course, the feature of vacuum Einstein equations is that they satisfy R mu nu equals zero. Therefore, the Ricci scalar vanishes. And so any and every solution to the vacuum Einstein equations has zero Einstein-Hilbert action. So that's not very good if we've got a whole set of physically distinct solutions that all have zero action. So the resolution that we'll sort of come to tomorrow is that, in fact, this sort of slightly illegal process here of ignoring that boundary term is in fact the clue that we can't just ignore it. We have to actually think about potentially, you know, we could think about it physically as having a dynamical boundary, or we can just think about it as finding a boundary term to cancel off that variation. Either way, what we need to do is to think about what happens to boundaries or hypersurfaces inside our manifold, and to think about something geometric that describes the physics of a fluctuating boundary, and that will hopefully cancel off this annoying term when we do a variational principle, and not only cancel that off to make this whole Lagrangian principle consistent, but with any luck, it's now going to break this degeneracy for the action of our vacuum solutions. So that's what we're going to do next.